Chapter 8 Corellian militants have claimed responsibility for contaminating water supplies to parts of Galactic City with FAXM-3. The attack, which left 456 dead and more than 5,000 with nerve damage, sparked yesterday's riots outside the Corellian embassy. CSF has doubled its police presence in Galactic City in a bid to prevent escalation of unrest. Galactic City authorities have declared a full terror alert and are asking the public to remain vigilant. But Admiral Chan Yathal has called for tough action to crack down on potential terrorists. HNE Morning Bulletin. Offices of Chief of State Omis, Senate Building, Coruscant. The HNE holocam hovered patiently as Chief Omis gave an earnest interview about the safety of Galactic City's water supply. Jason stood back and watched from the sofa in the corner of the vast office. Omis had a Naboo crystal jug on his desk and made a point, with subtle ease, of pouring a glass and sipping it occasionally while talking. There was nothing like a politician's personal display of confidence in the potability of Coruscant water. He even offered a glass to the reporter, whose expression told Jason that he knew he was being subjected to a little spin. The man drank anyway. He and Omis looked as if they were playing a child's game of dare.
"Extra security measures are now in place at all water company stations," said Omis, cradling his glass.
Jason had learned, fast, that meshing your hands on the desk gave the most reassuring image, so the trick with the glass of water would be far from invisible to HNE viewers.
"I'm confident there won't be a repeat of the sabotage earlier this week."
"Do you believe we're facing a genuine terrorist threat, or is this a random act?" said the reporter.
"It's a genuine threat, and it appears to be escalating." Omis didn't hesitate. "Even if we're not dealing with an identifiable formal terrorist organization."
"If you've identified that level of threat, then, do you feel you're doing enough to protect Coruscant citizens?"
This time, Omis did pause for a breath. Jason watched him calculate visibly, and he knew the politician was seizing an opportunity.
"I can assure you that our security services are taking every possible action."
"But you've been criticized by some politicians for not going far enough."
"We've gone as far as the current law permits."
"Some of your colleagues are calling for the internment of resident Corellians."
"That's a very big step. We're not at war."
"By the time we are, won't it be too late?"
Omis managed a regretful smile. "Let's not be hasty."
"Internment. That's my father you're talking about." Jason caught himself bristling at the suggestion, and then felt guilty for considering his own family before those who were being caught in the crossfire of something that was a war in all but name.
"Someone has to get a grip on this situation, and it's me."
His eye was caught by movement in the outer lobby, visible through a transparent steel panel. The outline was broken by the etched designs, but he recognized Senator Gasil, chair of the Security and Intelligence Council. As soon as the HNE reporter had finished the interview and left, Gasil slipped into Omis's office.
"It's not my job on the line," he said, pulling up a chair. "But I think our friend from the media had a point. Sorry. Just a little benign eavesdropping."
Jason knew why he had been summoned. He just wanted to see how they would broach the subject with him. Playing political games made him worry that personal ambition was driving him, but he was dealing with people whose stock in trade was maneuvering. So if he wanted their backing, he had to maneuver too. A Jedi was nothing if not pragmatic.
"I'm not comfortable with taking a hardline approach," said Omis. "And it might not be my decision to make."
Gasil gestured over his shoulder to the city beyond the room-width windows.
"Take a look out there. We have a trillion people on this world. A few thousand a tiny percentage, have been hurt directly by terrorism. The rest, though, think it's about to happen to them, and that's what we're dealing with here. Perception. Public confidence.
Omis raised one eyebrow.
Spin. Reassurance.
Jason had seen enough to add Gasil to his list of allies along with Neothel.
Fear breeds its own problems, said Jason. We have to limit that.
There was a moment's silence. Omis's shoulders dropped, and his presence in the Force was like a small piece of ice melting into nothing. His reluctance was tangible.
Mara Skywalker isn't willing to take on a security role, he said. You, however, seem equally able and a great deal more willing to do a thankless task.
Define the task, said Jason.
Fill the gap between the Army and the Coruscant Security Force.
"'Why are you talking directly to me and bypassing the Jedi Council?' Jason asked. "'I'm not even in the military.'
"'Because we're not asking you as a Jedi,' said Gasil. "'We're asking you as Jason Solo, and you'll be given a commission and a rank as Colonel. "'I'd bet the Council doesn't want to be tainted by messy stuff like this.'
"'They won't like it.'
Let's cut the PR speak. As a democracy, we've never been very adept at running secret police. You know, the kind of shock troops that Vader had when...
Gasil trailed off.
Sorry, Jason, no offense.
It's all right.
Jason meant it. He had come to terms with walking in his grandfather's footsteps, although he would not follow the entire path.
I'm not ashamed of Anakin Skywalker. And there are positive things I can learn from his example.
The office was suddenly and totally silent, as if both Gasil and Domus were holding their breath until Jason said it was okay to exhale.
"'Do we take that as a yes?'
Gasil asked.
"'Stang. I walk in here as a civilian, and I'll leave as a colonel. Jaina won't like that at all,'
Jason swallowed.
I'll need a security force to deal with it.
Omis looked to Gasil and then back at Jason.
CSF's anti-terrorist unit is yours to command?
No, I need my own team from the military and a few other sources, a team that's visibly separate from CSF. If civilian police are seen raiding homes and rounding up residents, it's going to make ordinary policing hard. Politically, it has to be separate. A Galactic Alliance Special Guard, if you like.
Gasil nodded.
I agree. You have to keep the secret police separate from the nice, polite officers who police the street. Sends a message that ordinary law-abiding Coruscanti have nothing to fear, while demonstrating maximum force to the enemy.
Omis was sitting on the edge of his seat, elbows braced on the desk, one fist clasping the other as he stared down in defocus.
You said rounding up.
Enchantment, said Gasil. And that's not just spin. Corellians got at the water supply pretty easily. One relatively small bomb shut 10 sky lanes for half a day. It takes very few people to cause a lot of disruption on a crowded planet like this. And let me remind you that this is also a nervous planet, not long recovered from another war. Makes folks paranoid.
Jason could see the path ahead of him, the path laid down specifically for him, the inevitability of his destiny that Lumia had shown him. Events were falling into place, and he was part of them with no option now but to accept his responsibility.
And we need to show any other world that might want to support Corellia that the Galactic Alliance isn't a pushover, he said.
Jason noted the inclusion.
Who is this we? I'm not elected. I'm not a member of the Jedi Council. I'm not even a master.
Internment is going to take a Security and Intelligence Council vote. Omis seemed resigned, but still salving his own conscience by doing things democratically. He gave Jason an odd look, a faint, bemused frown, as if remembering something, and looked a little past him. Then he appeared to focus again.
I'll need your lobby's backing.
Assume you have it, said Gasil.
Jason was more concerned over whom he would need to carry out the task. His instinct was to seek loyal, dependable foot soldiers.
I'd like to recruit Captain Shavu and a team of his choosing, he said.
He liked Shavu. The captain was uncompromisingly honest and had the feel and the force of a man who wouldn't shy away from dirty work.
I'd also like a company of special forces troops, and I need access to Alliance intelligence data.
Jason felt for a moment that he was standing outside his own body. How did I slip into this so easily?
You'll want NRI officers, then.
No.
Intelligence hadn't dealt with the threat up to now, so he had no idea whom he could trust.
This has to be seen as a fresh approach to the problem.
Omis radiated unease.
We've taken a step toward martial law.
Gasil interrupted.
But this is technically a Coruscanti matter. It's not a Senate issue. You have the powers to put a temporary order in place for the planet.
But Coruscant isn't just a planet. It's the Galactic Alliance, too. So I want full support for this. Or things will fall apart when we start applying those special measures, as you like to call them. People tend to lose their nerve when they see force applied.
A majority on the SIC would be legitimate authority to implement special measures.
And you can deliver that majority, can you? Said Omis.
I'll call a special meeting now. Give me 24 hours.
Gasil patted Jason on the shoulder with evident relief and left. Omis, sitting behind his desk with the air of a man in a heavily defended trench, watched Jason as if expecting him to break bad news.
"May I start assembling the personnel I need now?" Jason asked. "Then we'll be ready to move when the authority is given."
"Very well, let me speak to Admiral Pelion."
Omis opened the comlink set into his desk. It was the same pleak wood and lapis as the desk itself.
"And I'll get Shavu seconded to you."
"You can explain all this to the Supreme Commander in CSF?"
"I'm very good at being plausible," said Omis. "But I doubt if CSF is going to object."
Omis looked as if he was going to add something, and Jason was almost certain of what it would be. Pelion would resign if this was forced on him. That was what Jason was thinking, too. When Neothel took over the defense role, and she would, nobody doubted that, her support would be a springboard for what was to come. What had to come. But for the meanwhile, Jason had to prove to Coruscant, and to a watching galaxy, that not only could order be imposed on chaos, it could also be imposed for the good of the majority. He bowed slightly to Omis and left to make his way to the Strategic Command Ops Room, where he both felt and knew that Captain Shavu was still on duty, despite the fact that his shift should have ended 3 hours ago. Shavu was dedicated and forthright, and he'd have the best intelligence on where the Corellian troublemakers might be. Jason could help him pinpoint them with the imprecise but highly reliable senses that the Force had given him. They would make a formidable team. He, Ben, and Shavu. Varlo, Runadan, Waterfront District. Just as the salesman had said, the waterfront neighborhood was chic and full of the well-heeled professional classes. The taxi took him along the artificial river, a canal with carefully constructed rapids and a manufactured current. There was even lush greenery along the banks, and parkland extended back to the rows of shops and trendy restaurants. Fat, black cloak over his armor, felt utterly naked and concentrated on the fact that nobody would recognize him by his face. He decided he felt more at home in the kind of district where the bars were badly lit and a blaster was a necessity.
"I'm going to be working at Arumed," said Fett. "Where's the best place to buy a home?"
The taxi pilot glanced in his rearview mirror, and his eyes met Fett's.
It was the first time in years that anyone had really looked into his eyes and not just tried to stare through the visor.
Upper Parkway is where all the scientists buy a place. You a scientist?
I'm an anatomist. Yes, I know precisely where to shoot any one of 1,000 species for maximum stopping power.
You definitely want Upper Parkway, then.
Nightlife?
Pricey bars. Scallion bistros and wine bars, mainly.
The pilot wrinkled his nose disapprovingly.
I'm an ailed man myself.
How close to the Aromed labs?
5 minutes. Cozy little community.
All human?
You got anything against non-humans?
Just curious. Kaminoans hated sunlight. They were used to clouds, rain, and endless oceans. Fat doubted that an ornamental river would be water enough for town wee. I like to know my neighbors.
Only ever seen humans up there.
Maybe you don't know how to look. Drop me there. I want to check if I like the place. Upper Parkway was every bit as smart as the taxi pilot had said. The apartment towers were interspersed with townhouses, a real luxury on a crowded planet. And droids were still building properties on the edge of the park, for which the neighborhood seemed to be named. From the end of the boulevard, Fett could see the gray, monolithic building of the Aromed Laboratories, with its red, illuminated sign. An easy walk for anyone living in Upper Park. And, as the pilot had said, the place had several attractive bistros. He was perfectly at home, rappelling from a roof to capture a prisoner, or storming a building with blaster in hand. Walking into a bar and making cautious small talk was not his style, but it had to be done. Get it over with, Fett. Inside the bistro, everything was polished, orderly, calm. He walked up to the bar and took a seat, browsing the menu. Without his helmet, he could actually eat something. The novelty of that idea seemed astonishing, and reminded him how many things he had never done, and now might never do if he didn't find that data.
"Can I get you something?"
Again, Fett found himself looking into the face of a bartender. But this one was looking back as if he only saw a man, not a bounty hunter. Nobody else at the bar seemed to take any notice of him, either. He could usually bring nervous silence to a bar just by walking into it. "An ale," he said. "It's so simple. It's what everyone else does. One of the Corellian ones." A foaming glass appeared before him.
"Visiting?"
"Here's a man who makes a note of strangers. A cautious man. Thinking of buying a place here."
"Good time to buy, too."
The barman slid a glass bowl of some unidentifiable snack toward him.
"Now that Aromed's expanding, the prices will go crazy."
Fett sipped the ale, almost totally distracted by the simple freedom of having a drink in public. He tried the snacks, too, which turned out to be salt, sweet, and crunchy, like fried nuts. "Shares are doing well?"
"It's those scientists they poached from Santec. They say it's going to mean a big share of the gene therapy market."
"Santec. Fearfec, I guessed wrong." "Not Kaminoans, then?" The bartender laughed. A man farther along the bar turned to look at him.
"Ever seen one?"
"Steady. Yes, knew one very well indeed." The silence deepened. There was quiet, and then there was the silence of people taking serious notice, and the two did not sound the same.
"A customer here the other day said one had turned up at Arcanian Micro, but I think he was having a laugh," said the barman.
"Arcanian Micro. Well, if you deal in cloning, that's one more place to head." It was a knife-edge point in the conversation. Fett's stomach churned, and that rarely happened. Wrong planet, but maybe the right track.
"I knew a pathologist at Arcanian Micro,"
said a man sitting a little farther along the bar.
"She said some interesting things about Kaminoans."
"Ah, you're testing me. Do I work in the industry? Am I bluffing to get insider information? What, that they'd never go outside in the sunlight? That they're obsessed with perfection? The man considered him carefully.
That they're gray with long necks and incredibly arrogant once you get past the polite exterior.
Well, that confirms you've met one, or your friend has. Thanks. Fat busied himself with his ale. Not many people knew that much about Kaminoans. Over the centuries, only a handful of people had even known they existed, let alone seen them, or had enough contact with them to describe their outlook on the non-Kaminoan world. But industry insiders here knew, all right. Did Micro give them a nice dark hole to live in?
It was an issue, said the man, and looked satisfied.
So Kaminoans had probably defected to Arcanian Micro on Vohai. The intelligence was flimsy, but given that there was normally no intel at all on Kaminoans, it had a great deal more credibility. Fat had already worked out his route to the outer rim by the time he drained his ale, put his credits on the counter and stood up to leave. "I like this neighborhood," he said. On the way back to Slave One, he did what he had done so many times. He used his datapad to carry out an automated purchase of an asset. He bought half a dozen homes in Upper Parkway and transferred them to one of his holding companies. They'd double in value inside the year. It was as near as he ever came to indulgence, but he would never live in any of them. They were an investment. He never gambled. He speculated. What are you investing for? Why did you ever invest? When did you stop and think what you were going to do with it all? He hadn't. He was in it to succeed, to show how good he was. And the only person who would have cared how well he did, what a clever boy he'd been, was long dead. Fat flexed his fingers discreetly as he sat in the back of the taxi, feeling the joints and tendons burn. The pain was still occasional rather than ever present, but he knew it would get worse as his condition deteriorated. A few analgesics, when pain finally impaired his efficiency, would keep him going. No, he wasn't dead yet. But if Kosai had been one of the Kaminoans, he noted that plural, who fled to Arcanian Micro, then her research on aging hadn't gone with her. The company would have exploited it to the full by now. Anti-aging was always the preoccupation of affluent civilizations. It earned big credits. Maybe the talk in the bar was just rumor. No, enough hard detail had been revealed, and industry gossip tended to have a basis in reality. But maybe Kosai had never managed to halt or reverse the aging process. Then you're really dead, Fett. So shape up. As soon as he was clear of the taxi, he stripped off the robe and tunic, bundled it in the holdall, and put his helmet back on with genuine relief. It wasn't just a barrier against a world where he didn't truly belong. It was a piece of a kit, a weapon in its own right. He relaxed as the familiar welter of text and icons cascaded down the margin of the HUD and told him all was well with Slave One. He checked the various security cams remotely, staring through images of empty bays and secure hatchways at the permacrete strip in front of him. Even before Slave One came into view in one of the bays, he settled on an image of Myrta Gev. Still locked in the prisoner bay, she lay on the deck with her legs hooked over a bulkhead rail, fingers meshed behind her head, performing sit-ups. He hadn't come across women like her before. He hadn't come across many men like her, either. Whatever was driving her, she was serious about it. Discipline was a fine quality. He came perilously close to liking her again. Fool, she's ballast. He opened Slave One's forward hatch via his HUD link at 30 meters from the ship, climbed into the cockpit and flicked open the internal comm system. "Change of plan," he said. "We're going to Parmal Sector, Outer Rim." He waited for sounds of protest. Nothing. He checked the cam again to make sure Myrta was still there. "Did you hear me?"
"Yes."
She sounded a little out of breath and stood looking into the cam's lens. "You'll pay me sooner or later. I'm young. I've got time to wait." She had no idea how pointed that observation truly was. Fett wondered if she knew he was ill, but there was no way she could know he was dying. "Vohai," he said, and wondered why he volunteered the destination. She was making him drop his guard. Nobody managed that. He made a conscious effort to be himself again, untouched by anything beyond his own needs. "Sit up front where I can keep an eye on you." He released the security locks on the aft compartments and fired up Slave One's sublight drives. Myrta belted herself into the co-pilot seat just as the ship lifted, the acceleration flattening her like a punch. Fett paused. "I don't bother with the G-force dampers on takeoff." Why did I say that? He'd developed a rhythm of bare-bones conversation over the years. His passengers were never volunteers. Nobody wanted him to catch up with them. This was how it went. They whined, and he slapped them down, with a blunt word or sometimes a blunt object. Myrta didn't whine. He still felt the compulsion to slap down. She stared ahead from the view screen.
"I didn't pay for a ticket, so I'm not complaining."
There was no answer to that. Fett took Slave One out on manual to check that he could still pilot without computer assistance. So far, so good. The illness was still just pain, not yet infirmity. Runadan dwindled beneath them into a rusty red coin, and the viewport filled with star-specked void as Slave One cleared the planet. Then he took the risk of losing his main psychological aid to remaining aloof, and eased off his helmet. He expected Myrta to react, but she just glanced at him and then looked away again, apparently more interested in the starfield ahead.
"You're a clone, aren't you?"
said Myrta at last. She gets right to the point. "Got a problem with that?"
"No, I met a clone once."
"So did Aelin. She killed him."
"Only because she thought he was you."
"I don't want to chat." He didn't answer. Myrta persisted.
"But this clone said he'd fought a Geonosis."
"Couldn't have."
"Why?"
"Those clones were designed to age fast." Fett did a quick mental calculation, doubling the years. "He'd be a decrepit 140-year-old now."
"He was alive, all right."
The clone army had been designed to mature in 10 standard years, and then they carried on aging at twice or more the rate of ordinary men. Fett remembered feeling sorry for them as a kid, but his father had told him to be proud because they were perfect warriors. Sometimes he remembered that they were also his brothers. Whenever he met a stormtrooper going about Vader's business, he'd always wondered whether some remnant of his father's template, of himself, was behind that white visor. But he never asked. "When did you meet him?" Fett asked carefully.
"Last year. I got in his way on a job."
"Bounty hunting?" "Where? Don't rush her."
"Yes."
"A 140-year-old clone?" Myrta studied his face for a moment, impassive.
"He looked a lot like you, except for the scars."
"He'd be too old to even walk."
"Oh, he could walk all right, and handle a weapon. Big scary guy with a custom Verpine rifle and this long, thin, three-sided knife."
"No clone from the Grand Army of the Republic could have survived, let alone have left the service. Their whole life was fighting. How could they have coped on their own?" "But clones were men, and they had been scattered across the galaxy in the war, so it was inevitable that some had fathered children. This had to be one of them. He was almost reassured to know that the clone bloodline hadn't been erased completely, but he wasn't sure why. You sure?
Yeah. He said his clan name was Skirata.
Skirata. Fett jerked his head around and knew instantly that he'd displayed too much interest. But he knew that name. Back on Kamino in the years before the war with the Separatists started, his father had had a friend called Skirata, a short, tough, fanatical man who trained clone commandos and, according to his father, was the dirtiest fighter he'd ever known. He seemed to like that about him. What else did he say?
That he and some of his brothers left the army after Palpatine came to power. He wasn't very talkative.
You're definitely related. That made Fett pay much closer attention. No clone from the Kamino labs could have survived this long, except unaltered ones like him. Or one whose accelerated aging process had been halted. Only Ko-Sai knew enough to be able to do that. I'm interested, he said.
Why?
He'd rarely needed to lie, but he lied now. They'd be my brothers, too, wouldn't they? And then he wasn't sure how much of that was actually untrue. He had always been alone, just the way he liked it, and now he was suddenly curious about not being that way. Myrta leaned back in the seat and looked up at the deckhead. The Heart of Fire was strung around her neck, which struck him as an odd thing for a bounty hunter to do with an object she'd retrieved. She was just a young girl, and girls liked baubles, but she didn't seem the type to go in for jewelry.
"He looked like you, more or less," she said at last.
She tugged at the necklace like worry beads. "He had full Mondo armor. Light gray. And these pale gray leather gloves with an unusual grain." She held both hands out above her lap, palms down, fingers spread, as if she was imagining those gloves on her own hands. Really immaculate gloves. Fett thought gray, and an image of Town Wee's long silver gray neck and neat yellow-eyed head dominated his field of view, as vivid as his helmet's display right there in front of him, and yet somehow not there. If Myrta wasn't spinning him a line, then someone had managed to get hold of Ko-Sai's data, and they made use of it. But maybe she knew more than he gave her credit for. His father had taught him to watch out for traps. This was so close to what he wanted to hear that it triggered every suspicious nerve in his body, which was all of them. If those clones survived, why haven't I heard about them before? If this kid's trying to set me up for something, she's got a lot to learn. Even Aelin had tried to kill him once. He glanced sideways at Myrta.
Fairfax, you look just like him when you do that.
She looked rattled.
It's the way you tilted your head.
Whoever the man with the gray gloves was, he seemed to have made an impression, or else she was an expert actress. She had a tight grip on the Heart of Fire as if to protect it. Fett decided to make sure she was secured in the aft section when he needed to sleep. She still seemed to think that the goods she had to sell was Aelin's location. Maybe she didn't realize that she now had two things he wanted— and that was information on both his dead wife and, impossible, but he couldn't ignore it, his living brothers. If she had known, she'd have asked him to pay for it. But Myrta had the necklace. It was somehow all he could recall of Sintas Vel at that moment. He suddenly missed her, and he knew he had no right to. Senate Lobby 513, Senate Building, Coruscant, 0835 hours. Admiral Pelion resigned as Supreme Commander of the Galactic Alliance Defense Force at 0800, a little too late for the main morning holonews bulletins, but early enough to interrupt drive-time programming for a few moments. He had objected strenuously, in private, to the powers granted to the Galactic Alliance Guard, but said nothing publicly. He was an old man. Nobody outside Omis's cabinet, and presumably the military, thought it unusual that he should let a younger officer take his place. Jason watched the news on the chamber's holoscreen, sound muted. While he wasn't surprised that Pelion had finally gone, he still wasn't prepared for the speed at which events were moving. He wondered if Lumia had influenced matters somehow, but she denied it. She sat beside him in the deserted lobby chamber, document case on her lap, face invisible under that dark red cowl and veil. The chamber was normally full of lobbyists and media seeking audience with senators, but it was too early for the majority of the power brokers to be about their business. The Jedi Council, though, was meeting Neothel in the Supreme Commander's suite, and it was interesting that she had not gone to see them, but that they had come to her. "Start as you mean to go on," Jason wondered what Uncle Luke would make of the Mon Calamari officer. She would replace Omis one day. He hoped Luke would see that coming and support her, so that the war would be short and sharp, and so Jason wouldn't have to take up the mantle Lumia had thrust upon him. "There you go again. You know this is meant to be. You can't avoid it. Lumia is part of the inevitable, just as you are. Submit to it."
"Tell me you didn't influence Admiral Pelion," said Jason quietly. "I didn't need to. He's furious about your appointment, and he's old."
Lumia's voice was so low that Jason almost had to amplify it with the force in his mind.
"By the time he decides he wants to return, it'll be too late for him to stop you."
The resignation of an elderly chief of defense was no shocking news story for HNE, merely a chance to recap on Pelion's distinguished career. But the succession of Admiral Neothel was significant. She was known as a hardliner. Jason switched the wall-mounted holoscreen to a Corellian news station where her appointment was provoking reaction. Thrakken Sal Solo, head of state, was holding forth on the certain threat to Corellia. With the audio muted, Jason lip-read. Sal Solo announced that Centerpoint Station would be brought back online for the defense of Corellia within 3 months.
"You have an interesting selection of relatives," said Lumia. "All the more reason for me to do the decent thing and sort out the problems the various branches of my family appear to be visiting upon the galaxy. You're more like your grandfather than you think."
Lumia knew Anakin Skywalker as her Lord Vader. He'd selected her as an intelligence agent.
"I haven't failed to notice the parallels," said Jason. "And that makes you wary?"
"I've seen the steps he took." "Literally, Grandfather, I stood behind you and watched you kill children."
"I have to do things a little differently." "And you still want Ben Skywalker as your apprentice?"
"Yes."
Lumia emanated satisfaction, as if this was an extra layer of vengeance on Luke. But he knew she was past that point.
"That's a choice only you can make."
"If there's another candidate, I can't think of one."
"Are you still going ahead with the Galactic Alliance, Guard?"
"Why wouldn't I?"
"You have an ally in the Supreme Commander now," she said. "You could go straight to the military solution."
"There's still a real job to be done in restoring security here, and Neothel needs time to stamp her leadership on the GADF, and Chief Omis."
"Commendable pragmatic analysis."
Jason wondered if he was taking a risk by having this discussion in the Senate building. But if any of the Jedi Council were as adept as he was at listening in the Force, he suspected they would be too tied up in their discussion with Neothel to hear. What would they be saying to her? He could listen. He could snatch the sounds out of the air from behind closed doors at the far end of the floor and witness for himself, but it was irrelevant and he didn't need to. He knew they would be pressing caution on her. He also knew Neothel would smile politely in that tight-lipped way of hers, twist her head sideways to stare them out, and say that she thanked them for their counsel. Then she would ignore that counsel. Jason's mind leapt away from the business at hand for a brief moment, and he found himself wondering why the Jedi Council hadn't given his grandfather the guidance he needed as a Padawan. If they knew he was the chosen one, why had no master from the Council taken on the role of training him?
Poor Obi-Wan. They dithered and left the task to you. Now they're dithering over another galactic war.
On the holoscreen, Corellian political commentators had worked themselves into a froth of outrage at Neothel's appointment. Jason switched channels back to HNE just as the sound of footsteps began echoing down the long passage to his right. The meeting in the Supreme Commander's office had ended.
"Relax," said Jason.
He centered himself and projected a force illusion around Lumia to bolster her own cloaking of her identity again. He felt the sensation of a ball of heat building in his chest, and he nudged her with his elbow.
"Go on. Brief me on the strength of the Corellian fleet, and don't react to anyone passing by."
Jason and Lumia waited. The lobby and the corridor leading off it were empty. Eventually they heard boots thudding fast on the marble floor. Luke's, for certain, as if he hadn't much enjoyed the meeting and wanted to get out.
"Okay, Lumia, let's see how you react to Luke this time, and how he reacts to you."
Luke approached them, eyes downcast, distracted and frowning. He seemed about to walk past Jason, and then paused to acknowledge him as if it was an effort.
"Are you waiting for Neothel?"
asked Luke.
"I'm paying my respects as head of the Galactic Alliance Guard."
Jason indicated Lumia.
"This is a colleague from the university's Defense Studies Department."
Luke nodded politely at Lumia, then turned back to Jason.
"Are you certain that's the right choice?"
"If I don't do it, who will?"
"Maybe nobody should," said Luke. "If Chief Olmos needs that job done, I'll do what I can."
Luke fixed Jason with a frank blue gaze for a few moments. But he didn't look at Lumia again, and more to the point, Lumia didn't look at him.
"Mind how you do it," Luke said,
a slight frown still creasing his nose, and walked away. Jason waited a full 10 minutes, still holding the heat in his chest to maintain the illusion, before relaxing.
"I'm impressed by your ability to deceive, Luke," said Lumia, "and you appear to have no doubts or misgivings about it."
Jason stood up. Lumia had been given the best chance she had for decades to kill Luke Skywalker, and she hadn't shown the slightest inclination to take it.
"No doubts," said Jason, "but no enthusiasm either."
"That's as it should be," she said. "Tell me what your next task is."
There was no harm telling her. It would be all over HNE in a few days.
"Internment," said Jason. "We're confining Corellians until this current wave of terror is contained. Come on, let me introduce you to the officer who'll be in the Chief of State's office within the year."
Internment. Extreme, dangerous, and inevitable. When you could let go of your own need to be the hero, the admired one, the respected, and face being reviled for doing a necessary job, then you had finally overcome the most poisonous attachment of all, the love of ego. Jason was prepared to be hated in pursuit of a greater good.